This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In about 90 minutes, President Obama is scheduled to address the nation about what went wrong on Christmas Day when a would-be suicide bomber tried to blow up an airliner over Detroit. The president is expected to outline the intelligence flaws that failed to keep the alleged bomber, 23-year-old Nigerian Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, from boarding that plane to the U.S. He's also expected to outline new steps intelligence agencies will take to prevent other such attacks and anticipate tactics that have not been tried as yet. National Security Advisor James Jones, in an interview with USA Today, said Americans will feel, quote, a certain shock when they learn about the intelligence lapses. Today, the Los Angeles Times reported that U.S. intelligence did flag the Nigerian, but not until after he had boarded the plane for Detroit. As we await the president, we'll look at what happened in this case, what it means for national security, and the political implications for the president. If you have questions about that, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston is with us from our bureau in New York. Dina, always nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And Kevin Whitelaw, who covers national security and terrorism for NPR.org, is with us here in Studio 3A. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
And Dina, let me talk with you first. We're told that the president has said there was a failure to connect the dots. Are we hope today to find out more about what those dots were?
What the dots were and exactly what the disconnect was. I mean, it's counterintuitive, but the truth is that when you look at the Abdulmutallab case, there are a lot of things that went right. There were a lot of places where intelligence needed to be, and they actually were. Let me give you an example. On December 17th, there was a big raid in Yemen on al-Qaeda in Yemen's operational headquarters, and they arrested a bunch of people. Then there were airstrikes targeting the same kind of people on the 24th of December, and my sources tell me that those two events were all about disrupting what they knew was a holiday plot by some kind of Nigerian. And they knew that because they were listening to phone calls, and they heard in the phone calls and communications among these people that there was this plot brewing. So they were listening to the right phones. They seemed to be targeting the right people. And where this fell down was in this last link. They didn't get Abdulmutallab in time.
And if you're describing all those things in sequence, you're describing an operation where disparate parts of the government, the intelligence services, are talking with each other. If phone calls were intercepted, that was NSA, almost certainly the National Security Agency, telling then the Central Intelligence Agency what's going on.
Exactly. Exactly. And you've got, clearly you have to have CIA talking about raids and working with the Yemenis to actually do that because they don't have boots on the ground or that many boots on the ground. And then, you know, you've got CIA actually calling in these airstrikes. So I'm not being an apologist by any stretch about this, but it's important to sort of, we keep focusing on the failures, and I think it's important to step back. And the reason why we're hearing Obama administration officials saying what is going to come out of this is a tinkering of the edges of the program as opposed to a complete overhaul of the way we do intelligence is because in a lot of respects, this worked. And if they had actually caught Abdulmutallab in Amsterdam, this would have been a rousing success.
But they did not get that intelligence, Kevin Whitelaw, at least according to the Los Angeles Times, until he was already in the air. What are we learning about that?
Well, as best we can tell, the report is that when anyone flies into the United States, their names are run against several different databases. And what happens first is before they board the plane, their names are run against a terrorist watch list. This is a big database with about 400,000 names on it. This is run and operated by something called the Terrorist Screening Center, which sits inside the FBI. He was not on that list. He was never put on that list because they didn't know enough about him. So his name did not come up when they ran that trigger. After he was on the plane, then his name was automatically run, as it is for every flight coming to the United States, against a separate database, which is housed inside the intelligence community in the National Counterterrorism Center. And this is a terrorist identities database. It's got about 550,000 different names on it. And this was where his name had come because his father had reported him missing and of being a potential concern. return to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria. His name did make it onto that database. So authorities discovered this and were planning to do some form of secondary screening when he upon arrival in the United States.
Which, of course, would have been too late had his device worked properly, and perhaps 300 lives would have been lost. And so you can describe it at best as a near miss, but the miss is good as a mile in any case.
Well, that's right. You know, at the same time, I think, you know, again, the perspective on this is that the U.S. gets so many of these different kinds of reports. About 7,000, thousands and thousands of names are flooding into the National Counterterrorism Center every day from a whole range of different sources. We're talking from intelligence agencies, from the military, from eavesdropping, from all kinds of different things. Are being come into that center for not essentially nominating them to be on that terrorist identities database. So they have to have dozens of staffers there going through these thousands and thousands of names that come in every day to sort through what's real and what's not. And it's everything from my neighbor is Al-Qaeda and my cousin and my uncle who I don't like is Al-Qaeda to something that, like this, turns out to be an extremely good tip. And so that's where...
From this young man's father, who went to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria and said, I have real concerns about this. And we've heard about that in the past. But Dina Temple-Raston in New York, if various intelligence services were evidently talking with each other about this a Nigerian in general, the State Department never got the word and never reconsidered the multi-entry visa that he'd been given beforehand.
Exactly. I mean, his father came in. My understanding is that his father came in and talked to people in the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Nigeria, and basically talked about his son being gone and how worried he was. He didn't know where his son was. He had gone missing, and he wanted the U.S. to help him find his son. And then apparently he also said that he was concerned that his son had been radicalized. But the way he had put that together, there was a sense from the people who heard him that this was not something that was imminent. This wasn't something that they needed to worry about right away. And what they ended up sending is something called a visa viper. And a visa viper is essentially a flag that says there's a guy that somebody has complained about. It might be a problem. We're just letting you know. To give you an idea of how many visa vipers go out in a single day, there are about 180 U.S. embassies around the world. Each one of them probably sends one viper, visa viper, back to the United States every day.
So this is, in terms of, this is a torrent of information and obviously a lot of people to be concerned about. Nevertheless, that's somebody's job, isn't it?
Well, it is. And what's supposed to happen then is it's supposed to go to the National Terrorism NCTC, mm-hmm. National Counterterrorism Center, and they're supposed to analyze it. But what apparently they got from the embassy was something that was very cursory. And it was what they call an ops report, which was essentially minimal amount of information with very little detail, as opposed to a complete intelligence report. Hadn't a complete intelligence report actually gone out, there would have been something to actually analyze and decide whether or not it was important. And instead, that didn't happen. So the context that they needed wasn't there.
And there's another part that I've not heard addressed, and I wanted to ask you about this, Kevin, and that is, this was Christmas Day, the run-up, and just before Christmas Day. Is there any evidence that there's, people paying more attention to the office party than maybe they should have been paying to these visa vipers they're getting from these agencies?
Well, I do think the amount of activity that was going on surrounding this plot that they believed they were onto that was emanating out of Yemen shows that there was in the counterterrorism agencies quite a lot of focus, at least on that particular plot. You could always look at things like holiday staffing. You could look at a lot of different questions, and I am sure all those questions will be asked, and we'll see if this report contains any answers on that. The one question that has been raised is that, why did nobody check before this name was added to the terrorist identities database whether or not he had a U.S. visa, which, of course, he did. And there's been some finger-pointing back and forth between whether the State Department, whether the embassy should have done that, whether that was the responsibility of the NCTC analysts. That's something that we've already seen President Obama address, and that is going to be something that State Department will be checking in these kinds of reports from here on out as a matter matter of course.
Kevin Whitelaw writes on national security and terrorism for NPR.org. Also with us, NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. The president will be issuing a declassified version of his account on what went wrong in the run-up to this attempted bombing of a plane over Detroit on Christmas Day. And let's talk with Jay. Jay's on the line with us from Cape Cod.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I fly regularly, and I'm not afraid to fly. And I just wonder if we're not overdoing this terrorist menace. The terrorists have killed many people in the United States over the 10-year period, maybe as many as 3,000 in the United States. I wonder how many people have been killed in automobile accidents or killed by people who walk around them. Like today, somebody walked into a plant and shot three people. We don't talk about all the fear that we should engender by people walking in and shooting people, but we get off the wall on this issue about the risks of terrorism. I think you guys are overdoing it. There's too much being talked about on the risks of terrorism when the risks of living your life and walking out in the street, in fact, are far greater.
You're right to point out that something on the order of 100 people every day get killed in traffic accidents around the country. But Dina Temple-Raston, this is not the result of a conspiracy by people setting out to kill Americans.
No, and I think while his point is well taken, I don't think the difference is you can kill 300 people at a time. I mean, the flight 253, Northwest Flight 253, had 289 people on it. And one young man who was determined to do something could have brought all those people down. Plus, Al-Qaeda is very savvy about these things now. They really want these kinds of operations to happen over U.S. cities so that, one, cameras can get it and they get the biggest bang for their buck, if you'll excuse that expression, and they'll also hurt people on the ground. And I think that changes the complexion of this very much. I don't think we're trying to hype this up, but I think it's important that it get the right amount of information and fix what's broken in this.
And to your earlier point of things working for the most part, failing at the last step, but nevertheless, there have been no successful attacks on American airliners since 9/11. Nevertheless, if you think about the effects that could have had beyond the 300 people on that plane and whoever may have been below, remember what happened to the stock market and all kinds of other financial markets after 9/11 and questions being asked about all kinds of things. Anyway, stay with us. We'll talk more about what we expect to hear from the president later today when he talks about the attempt to blow up Northwest Flight 523. Dina Temple-Raston is with us, NPR counterterrorism correspondent. Also, Kevin Whitelaw, who works for NPR.org on national security and terrorism. Up next, White House correspondent Scott Horsley on the political challenges facing the president. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later today, President Obama will lay out a review of the intelligence failures that allowed a Nigerian man to allegedly try to blow up Northwest Airlines Flight 253. The president is expected to tell us how things could change to make sure intelligence agencies connect the dots in the future, including an order to U.S. agencies to move faster and more accurately in adding suspects to a watch list designed to stop terrorists before they strike. To help us decipher what all this means, both on and off airplanes, we have two of NPR's reporters with us. Dina Temple-Raston is NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. She's with us from New York. Kevin Whitelaw, who reports on national security and terrorism as a correspondent for NPR.org, is with us here in Studio 3A in Washington. And joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley with us from the White House. Scott, nice to have you with us as always.
Good to be with you, Neil.
And we need to remember that this event happened while the president himself was on vacation in Hawaii, and he's been criticized for being slow off the mark.
Yeah, the White House was a little flat-footed in their early response to this, at least the public portion of their response. I know on Christmas evening when news of this event first broke, we were told that the president was being briefed and he got regular updates in Hawaii. But he didn't come out and appear on camera to address this situation for several days afterwards. And in the meantime, of course, his Homeland Security Secretary had gone on the Sunday talk shows and made that inartful statement that the system had worked. She had to retract that the next day and clarify that she meant the system of getting planes out of the sky in the immediate aftermath, not the intelligence gathering that had gone on before. But they were a little slow off the mark in publicly addressing this. There's no sign that the president's vacation was actually interfering with him, you know, staying on top of what was going on behind the scenes.
And there's been a lot of political fallout, too. The right has been attacking the president. It was former Vice President Cheney issued a statement to the newspaper Politico accusing the president of trying to pretend we are not at war.
Yeah, there have been criticisms from Republicans, really not so much about the specifics of the White House response to this situation, but rather sort of using this as a club to beat up on the president on the things that the Republicans always go after the Democrats for being soft on national security. You've had people who have been unhappy all along with the president's plan to close the Guantanamo prison base, using this as an opportunity to make that point again. And there's been criticism of the decision to prosecute the suspected bomber in this case in civilian court rather than as a military combatant, although, as the Obama administration points out, that's the same choice that the Bush administration made with another would-be airline bomber, Richard Reid, the shoe bomber.
The shoe bomber, who is, of course, now in prison. And there has also been a stress on continuity when John Brennan, the advisor to the president, was on the talk shows this past Sunday. He kept saying, well, yes, we have released some of the Guantanamo detainees to Yemen, but not as many as our predecessors did in the Bush administration.
That's right. Now, there was one concession from the administration yesterday when they made clear that they are at least temporarily suspending the repatriation of any Yemeni detainees at Guantanamo to their home country, given the instability in that country right now, not just the suspicion that Yemen supplied the explosives used in the attack on Northwest Flight 253, but also just the ongoing instability in that country. So they've said, we're not going to be sending any Yemenis home from Guantanamo for now. But at the same time, the administration reiterated its plan, its commitment, which has been, you know, slow in coming, to close the Guantanamo base. They continue to say that the presence of that offshore prison camp is effectively a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda.
And another thing, Scott Horsley, that we keep hearing about, the president talked about holding those responsible accountable. Yes, those behind the plot, yes, but also those who may have made mistakes that allowed this nearly to succeed. Is there any indication that anybody, is going to lose their job over this?
Well, so far, the White House has really stood behind the people who have, you know, taken the most arrows. The president is taking personal responsibility for what went wrong. And so far, there doesn't seem to be a lot of indication that the public is holding President Obama to blame for what went on. You know, we've been watching the daily tracking poll on Gallup, and there's been virtually no movement in the president's approval rating since Christmas Day. So whatever shots the Republicans have taken don't seem to have really landed on the president on this case.
One more question for you, Scott, and that is the president's remarks were originally scheduled for 1 p.m. Eastern time, then bumped to 3 p.m. Eastern time. Now we're told 4:30. Any understanding as to why?
No, and that's a good question. I mean, one of the challenges for the White House here is maybe not so much the Republican attacks, but just trying to show that they're on top of things. And we were told yesterday that this report would be made public early this afternoon. And whether it's a case of trying to scrub that declassified summary before they make it public, or perhaps it's some of the other things that are on the president's calendar today. For example, he is scheduled to be meeting this afternoon with former President Bill Clinton. He has some other meetings on his calendar. So whether it's that other business or some delay in scrubbing this report for publication, it's hard to tell.
All right. Scott Horsley, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you, Neil.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley with us today from the White House. And again, our counterterrorism correspondent, Dina Temple Raston, is with us from New York. And also we have Kevin Whitelaw, correspondent for NPR.org, with us here in Studio 3A. And let's go next to Don. And Don's with us from Denver.
Hi.
Hi, Don.
I'd like to ask your guest why the system isn't set up so that it's inverted from what it is right now, so that you have a can-fly list instead of a 40,000-strong can't-fly list and a 400,000-strong watch list. It seems to me it'd be much easier to check on people who want to fly instead of looking through a haystack for a needle, sort through the needles that present themselves at wanting to buy a ticket to fly on an airliner. I mean, flying is a privilege, not a right. But the way it's set up right now, anybody can show up in Africa with cash and buy a ticket and get on an airplane, whereas if it were a can-fly list, you would have to, in advance, purchase your ticket and Right now, you can get an app on your iPhone that does it back.
Don, I think you may be misstating the size of these particular haystacks. I think there is something like 4,000 names on the don't fly list or can't fly list. And Dina Temple-Raston, there's some like 600 flights across the Atlantic every day, and who knows how many within this country.
Exactly. I mean, there's a difference between this so-called tide list that he was put on, which has about 550,000 people on it, and the so-called no-fly list, which is 4,000 or 5,000 people. It's a much smaller... The problem with the no-fly list, and this is why people have complained about it, is when you go to the gate and your name happens to match somebody else's, and you, or it looks very... the same, you've got the person at the gate or at the front counter of the airline having to tell you you don't fly, and they become the bad guy. And so there's been a lot of pushback as to who gets put on these no-fly lists. And this is part of the problem that's been going on to now.
So, Don, it's a lot easier to handle a list of about 4,000 to 5,000 names. They would be much easier to control than a much larger list of those who were cleared to fly. I think Don has left us anyway. We thank him for his call. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Steven's on the line from Sacramento.
Yeah, hi. First, let me just add to Don's question. That's kind of the way Israel does it, but it's a lot of lead time before you ever get on a plane.
And again, a much smaller volume of traffic.
Exactly. Yeah, my question is the sheer volume of data that's collected right now, how does that contribute to the trouble to analyze? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, there were these dots. Why weren't the dots connected? But the sheet of paper is entirely black and dripping with ink. You know, I've heard one comment somewhere that they collect approximately four times the volume of data that's in the Library of Congress daily. Trying to go through that volume of data.
Kevin Whitelaw, is that an apt analogy?
Yeah, that's actually an approximate statistic that they use to try to describe it. And keep in mind, when they talk about that, they're talking about volumes and volumes of telephone conversations and emails, and it's incredible amount of stuff that on the electronic side that they're intercepting and can't begin to process at all. But absolutely, I think what we have learned in this episode is there were a surprising number of pieces about this plot and about this man that had actually been, collected in one form or another. But putting them together is an enormous, enormous challenge.
And Dina, you not only collected and recognized for what they were, but as you suggest, acted on in the days running up to this. But despite the failure to connect the last dots, nevertheless, there was a lot going on.
Was a lot of movement. It's sort of like if in the 9/11 attacks, they'd actually found the people who had gone to the flight schools. They might not have gotten all 19 people who were going to launch the attacks, but if they'd gotten the people at the flight schools, that would have been a rather big coup. I was just speaking to a source of mine who's in the intelligence community, and the way he put the metaphor he used for the dots was, do you remember those count by numbers, sort of you could draw a picture if you just followed the dots that were in
numbers,
orders?
Yeah.
Well, even less than that. You know, you have a constellation of stars or something, and you sort of follow the numbers that are next to the dots in order, and it becomes something, right?
Right.
Well, he said that what it's like is essentially having that kind of design, but not having any numbers on it. So you basically have dots, but you don't know which order they go in.
All right, Stephen, we're with you down Analogy Road, so appreciate your phone call. Thanks very much. Let's go to Mark, and Mark's calling from Minneapolis.
Oh, good morning, or afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What I don't understand in this conversation, half of the whole body scanners in the world were sitting in the airport that he left from.
That's in Amsterdam, in Schiphol.
In Amsterdam, half of them. They were not used because an American congressman from Utah was leading the opposition to use them because on the House floor, as he said, quote, I don't want my wife and children seen naked. The problem was someone was let on a plane with dangerous substances because we did not use existing technology. And now the same people who were opposing using that technology are going after the president for an intelligence failure.
Democrats, as well as Republicans, voted overwhelmingly in favor of a bill that was passed on the floor of the House of Representatives that would have sharply limited the use of that scanning technology. But Dina,
was
I'm sorry, but that wasn't really the problem here. The problem here was not how the U.S. felt about these particular scanners. And frankly, the jury is a little bit out as to how effective these scanners were or are and whether or not they would have found this particular explosive where it was on Abdulmutallab's body. But more importantly than that, the reason why they were not set up is because the EU didn't want them. The EU, in order to set up some, the EU has been against these machines for some time. So I'm fairly certain that the reason there was this problem in Amsterdam was not because of somebody here in Congress. I'm sure that added to it, but it was an EU issue, and that's the reason why they weren't all set up.
And remains Washington, one, I would talk
the
about.
The New York Times reported that it was American TSA opposition that prevented their being used on flights to the United States.
And my understanding from my sources,
that bit of information.
My understanding from my sources is that the reason why this full contingent was not used was because the EU has problems with this.
And Mark, it should be pointed out, still does, even after this incident, Britain, the Netherlands, and I think Italy have said they plan to go ahead with these body image scanners. But Germany, Belgium, and other states within the EU and France, I think, have all said they still have major questions about privacy issues, just what you were talking about, and about effectiveness issues, also about radiation and health issues. Until those are answered, they don't want to put these into effect. But thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking with Dina Temple-Raston, who's our counterterrorism correspondent, and with Kevin Whitelaw, who's a correspondent for NPR.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email that we have from Patrick in Geneva, New York. Terrorists are successful even if they don't detonate a bomb. We spend so much money to thwart them. Even an unsuccessful event will get us scrambling. And Kevin, you have to credit that email has got a point.
Well, absolutely. And one, you know, people talk about Al-Qaeda, obviously, all the time, try to understand, you know, why it plans the kinds of attacks it plans. And one of the questions that comes up is, why haven't we seen them try to do more sort of low-scale suicide bombings? They always seem to go for these really sort of fancy, spectacular attacks. But that is very much part of their strategy, because they are looking for the publicity and the attention that surrounds these big, big episodes. And it is absolutely a core part of their philosophy to try to carry out these things. They think it spreads their message. It builds new recruits and furthers their broader goals.
And indeed, that's reflected in the website announcements by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, this group in Yemen, that they're trumpeting even a failed attack as a success of sorts.
Claiming credit for supplying and directing and everything else. And there are signs that this was directed at pretty high levels.
Yeah. Let's go to Mildred. Mildred is calling us from Berkeley in California.
Hello. I'd like to ask about the information available to the crew of the plane, because as I understand it, this man went off to the John for 20 minutes, which should be reason to wonder, and came back and put a blanket over his head and tried to ignite himself. Surely by that time, the crew should have been on him. Were they informed? Did they know?
It's an interesting question, Dina. According to the Los Angeles Times, again today, there had been a red flag raised. He would have gotten special screening after landing in Detroit. Was anybody, any kind of message forwarded to the aircraft?
No, apparently not. And this is one of the things that the airlines are quite angry about. They think that they would have perhaps reacted differently if they had known that there was some problem with somebody who was on the plane. As far as being in a bathroom for 20 minutes, I'm not sure that is an enormous red flag.
No.
Okay.
Possibly not.
Okay.
May I just observe that talking about connecting the dots is asking of people who are presumably very wise and sophisticated that they play a children's game. I wish we'd drop that figure of speech, but that's minor.
Well, okay.
Thank you.
Mildred, thanks very much. And as we await the president's announcement, and again, this is expected, I guess, in about an hour's time, unless it's bumped again by the White House. But Dina Temple-Raston, just remind us, we're looking for, is there going to be information about intelligence failures, about screening failures, and about changes in the future?
I think we're going to see what we call in journalism business TikTok, which is basically going to be what happened and when did it happen. I think something that we didn't make clear enough when we were speaking earlier was about when you were talking about whether or not Christmas is one of the reasons why people maybe weren't alert enough. Well, the actual complaint from the father, or the concern about the father, came on November 19th. So there was plenty of time. So that wasn't the issue. It was that these, and I won't use connect the dots, but it's because these various threads didn't come together that they didn't know that this is what they should be on the lookout for. I mean, one of the things that they're talking about now, and it'll be interesting to see whether or not this ends up being in the report, is that, you know, everybody's against racial profiling or profiling of somebody. You know, does that mean if you're Arab, you always get pulled out of line? But something that they don't do is they don't marry together intelligence and profiling. So, for example, and I'm not saying that I'm for this, but this is something that may come out and what we're going to see in the report. If you have from the NSA an intercept in which you have people from Al-Qaeda in Yemen saying, we've got the Nigerian for the holiday plot, why wouldn't you start to have a little more focus on young Nigerians coming through the line?
Dina Temple-Raston, thanks as always for your time.
You're welcome.
NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston with us from New York. Kevin Whitelaw, who writes on intelligence and national security and terrorism for NPR.org, joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.